You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, December 15th, 2022, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Tara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Hello, Phoenix.
And George Robb.
Arizona. Hello.
As you can hear, we are recording in front of a live audience. Most of them are alive anyway. And we are in Phoenix. Evan always steals my thunder by saying the name of the city that we're in.
You don't tell me to not steal your thunder.
I'm just wondering if you're ever going to figure it out on your own. You haven't so far.
You have yet to detect my pattern that when we do these live events, live audiences in a town, in a new city, that I will acknowledge the city.
That's Evan's thing.
I know. So how is that stealing your thunder?
So I've been to Arizona a few times before. Jay, I know Jay had a close friend, Michael Orticelli, who lived in Arizona, so you've been here
I've been here many times.
Many times. Any of the rest of you been here before?
No. Grand Canyon. We visited the Grand Canyon in 2014 when we were in Las Vegas for TAM that year.
Yeah.
But that's it. That's my only Arizona experience.
I did a percussion convention in Phoenix probably 20 years ago or so. The PASIC, the Percussive Arts Society International Convention. It's a great time. It's a room probably four times the size of this, all filled with drums, and you're in there for about 9 seconds, and you just want to eat your own face. It's like every drummer in the United States banging away. Yeah, it was awful and awesome at the same time. But it was lovely. It was lovely. That was like in October-ish, so shade was like perfect, 72, and as soon as you stepped into the sun, your skin disappeared.
Yeah.
It was amazing, the disparity between the shade and the non-shade.
Did they have like breakout sessions for bongos or things like that?
You wouldn't believe the breakout sessions. I mean, like triangle repertoire. There's these new triangle mallets. Like, you got to try them out. There's going to be like a 45-minute demonstration about with Shostakovich excerpts for triangle beater. Yeah, it's like the hardest core, deepest dive kind of stuff. Yeah, it's insane.
Just be straight up honest with me.
Yeah.
Is there really a skill in playing the triangle?
Oh, no question. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's...
What? Like angle of attack? Like, what do you...
Well, there's timbre, there's tone to begin with. But when you're playing something like, let's say, the Shostakovich... I think Shostakovich 7 has this great...
Okay, so it's like drumming on attack.
Do a triangle roll. Like, how do you make a triangle sustain a note over as long as you want it to? Well, you have to roll. So you get in the corner and you go ding 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 ding, but you got to make it sound like ah. So yeah.
Okay.
Not to be, you know, all percussy about the whole thing.
Yeah, Jay was thinking just would hit it.
Yeah, like, ding. Yeah. You know, it's not Ed Grimley. Yeah, it's not
there's
quite
more,
that.
There's more to it than that.
Level? It's not Ed Grimley level.
So I have a Phoenix story. I don't remember if I ever talked about it on the show.
Hit me.
So it was in the 90s. I was here visiting my friend Michael. And one of his friends found a human skull out in the desert.
Whoa.
What?
Yep. And oddly...
And you turned it into the local coroner.
No.
Or they turned it.
No. So oddly, it had numbers written on the back of it, on this, you know, on the back of the skull right here.
666?
No, but that would have been pretty freaky if it did. So I'm like, shit, I want to take it home and give it to Bob, because Bob has one of the biggest skull collections in the freaking world.
That does not seem legal.
Now, we're going back to the 90s, and this is everything I'm saying is...
Everything is legal in the 90s.
This is 100% true. So I call the airport up, and I'm like, can I bring... I'm like trying to couch it like, can I bring a bone sample on the airplane? Like, yeah, you could, sure. You could put it, you know...
He's so, like, I don't want to tell the authorities, so I call
first thing,
the airport.
Call the airport, yeah. What to do when you find a skull? Call the airport.
So we put it in a box, tape it up.
You had a skull in the box?
I had a skull in the box.
It's in the box.
And then I get out at, you know, curbside check-in, and I tell the guy, I'm like, hey, I'm just triple checking here. Like, I have a skull in this box, and I want to know if I could take it on the airplane. The guy goes, you could take it on the airplane, you just can't talk to it.
As if you're going to break into Hamlet or something. Yeah. Look at the skull.
Now, just play this through with me. I'm going through a security, and there's an X-ray machine. And I'm kind of like, what's going to happen? You know, like I have no idea what's going to happen. So thing goes. So I for some reason I get picked a lot to be the guy that they pat down and you know whatever. It happens to me like 1 out of 10 times I'm the guy for some reason.
For everyone else, it's only 10%.
Yeah. So I happen to be the guy's got the wand on me, and I am like totally snake eyes looking at the woman with the that's got the X-ray machine, and she goes like this. So I'm you. They're patting me down, and she goes like this.
The slow burn.
So
the slow
as I see her head start turning, I just start going. So I start nodding at her, and it was one of the best moments I've had in this state. Mm-hmm. It was really cool. I had a skull on the airplane. It was in the thing, and it made me realize you never know what people have in the luggage compartment above your head. It could be 2 feet away from your head.
It's good to have extra headroom, Jay. You know, yeah.
Good, George. And now it's in my collection. Thank you.
But have you ever solved the mystery of where the skull came from?
This is a medical specimen. That's why it had a number on the back.
Probably.
Well, the guy found it in the desert, and I just assumed it was from a dig of some kind. I mean, but who knows? I mean, who was this person? It's a human skull.
You thought it was from an archaeologic dig, and you just stole it.
Basically.
Yeah. That's basically what he's saying.
What?
I didn't sell it or steal it. I transported it across state lines and gave it to Bob. All I did was transport it.
They only moved the stones.
Back then, in the 90s,
I did not give a shit.
Wacky 90s.
Bob, what have a statute of limitations on that.
How many real bones do you have, Bob? Like actual human bone. Do you have human bones?
I've got a human skull from Steve. Mm-hmm. Many years ago. I've got another human skull from Jay, which you just heard about.
Mine was obtained legally.
Yeah, that's you came legally. Was yours geriatric or does it have full dentition?
It's, which one?
Steve's
the one
has
teeth.
He's got a lot of teeth, but not all.
It's grade B. Right?
Okay.
So there's, when you buy a human skull, which you can do if you want for medical, educational purposes. I have one too. But there's.
And his is a lot better than mine.
Yeah, so there's.
Yours is grade A.
There are different grades.
Yeah.
Yeah, mine's the top one.
Yeah,
you can get it's all about the dentition. You can get perfect teeth or, you know, there might be a couple teeth missing.
What's the range here we're talking price-wise? Like kind of
big range. Like a geriatric skull with no teeth is like, I don't know, a few $100.
Yeah, $150, $200.
Okay.
Like full dentist.
You can spend like $2,000 on a really good quality skull.
Yeah.
But they've gotten
teeth.
They've gotten more rare recently because most of them were sourced from India. Mm. And India, like, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, decided we're not doing this anymore. I think they were mainly from criminals, you know, people who were incarcerated. And there was a lot of questions about whether or not they were ethically sourcing their human body parts. So they basically just shut it down.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now I don't know where they're coming from now. But
I think now it's all like they make really good, like artificial ones.
Yeah.
And so I think that's, I haven't done research though. I'm just talking out of my butt at this point. But I think that, so you can get the artificial ones, and they're heavy, and they got really great detail. If you wanted a real like full skeleton or skull, I think you're going to pay
a full skeleton would be thousands of dollars,
tens of thousands.
Yes.
Oh, you were asking about Arizona.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been to Arizona a bunch because I'm from Texas and I live in LA, in California. I live in California, just not temporarily. We did a road trip here with a bunch of friends of mine to Meteor Crater somewhat recently. I mean, I don't know, COVID made things weird, so it's probably a really long time ago now. But she is a moon crater researcher. She did her PhD from Caltech, and that's her focus of her research. So she had done a bunch of field work at Meteor Crater, so they gave us access to do like the full hike around the whole rim of the meteor. It was so cool.
It's big.
It's huge. And there's like a weird, like old kind of town where they were doing a bunch of research in the back, and you can find their hand forged nails still in the dirt and like the little structures where they were doing research.
It's amazing. The
awesome.
Meteor, like,
the human skulls.
The meteor just missed the gift shop.
Yeah.
It's amazing. Like right on the edge. It was amazing. Yeah. So lucky.
It totally has a Cthulhu vibe to it. You know, like
you know
there's
Cthulhu
a there's
is,
a
Karen?
No, I don't know.
You don't even know who Cthulhu is?
No, it's Cthulhu.
Oh, forget it. We'll talk about it later.
I mean, I feel like I know the word. Like, I've heard it used in...
You ever hear of Lovecraft?
Common parlance.
H.P. Like, you know,
Lovecraft?
Yeah, so he came up with...
The it's like a monster?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, the monster.
Octopussy kind of...
Yeah. It's so scary that you literally go insane if you see it.
Yeah, like you can't... rationally understand what you're seeing. That's
so
how.
So, what does the crater have to do with Cthulhu?
Well, just like the old abandoned town, and then there's a crater because Cthulhu is supposed to be from outer space. Like, so.
Oh yeah.
So
yeah.
It has.
Yeah. I can see that. It's like haunting
outer space?
Them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess.
It's fair.
Yeah, he's like on Pluto.
I feel like
or
there
something.
Was a plane. Am I misremembering? Like somebody was nodding, like they know a lot about the crater, like back here. Is there a plane that crashed into it? Like a small prop? I feel like they were doing. Somebody was doing something, and they crashed it, and it was like too much effort. For them to take it back out. But you could barely see it. Like, the crater's so big that it was like, you know that dot there? Yeah, anyway. It's cool. You should go if you haven't been.
All right, so we're going to move on with some news items.
Right.
We're going to start with what I think is definitely the biggest news item of the week.
Yes.
And that is the Fusion Breakthrough, scare quotes. Bob, what is going on here?
You know, a couple things. You know. You want more detail, Steve?
Always.
All right. So major. This is a no matter what he says. This is a major milestone in Fusion. The National Ignition Center, Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, announced. First, they leaked, and then they announced that they achieved ignition, and it's big. It's really big. There's a lot of caveats I'm going to throw at you, but this is big. Jill Ruby, head of the National Nuclear Security Administration, said. Monday, December 5th, 2022 was an important day in science. Reaching ignition in a controlled fusion experiment is an achievement that has come after more than 60 years of global research, development, engineering, and experimentation. So in this context, fusion is star power. I'm sure most of you, probably or all of you, know about fusion. That's how stars power themselves. It's essentially atoms of hydrogen smashing together to form helium, and helium's a little bit lighter. And what happened? Some of the mass is converted directly into energy, E equals MC squared. It could be a lot of energy, a tremendous amount, and it's clean energy. And ever since we discovered that stars are doing this, we were like, we want this. We want to do this ourselves. We want to have controlled fusion on the Earth.
But Bob, remember that bit of trivia? Most of the energy doesn't come from hydrogen combining into helium. It comes from hydrogen combining into other forms of hydrogen.
Oh, yeah,
I know. That's
a little detail. There's multiple steps along the way. They all release energy. That last step to helium isn't most of the energy.
I know.
Whatever.
Most of what I say is going to be just very high level and it gets... There's 40 layers of onion.
That's my new favorite trivia about this.
Yes, yes. And you're so proud of that. That was awesome, Steve. So what kind of fusion is there? So there's gravitational fusion. That's what the star does. It's all based on gravity. You get hydrogen and gravity, and you're going to get enough of that, you're going to get fusion. That's gravitational confinement. Then there's magnetic confinement. That uses a torus that's a donut-shaped magnetic field, and that confines the plasma, and the plasma gets hot enough to fuse. You've heard of tokamak and ITER and all that stuff. So that's magnetic confinement. Lots of research. Millions of dollars is being poured into them. Then there is inertial confinement. And that is essentially rapid compression of hydrogen. And it's called, who knows why it's called inertial confinement? Because that compression of hydrogen is imploding at 400 kilometers per second. It's going so fast that the fuel tries to dissipate, but it can't because it's going so fast. It can't get out of its own way. So they call it can't get out of its own inertia. So it's called inertial confinement. Which is interesting.
What do you mean going so fast?
It's compressing.
It's compressing.
It's moving inward at that speed.
Okay. How are they compressing it?
Oh my gosh!
In this example, it's lasers, and I'll get into those details today. So the National Ignition Facility has been tweaking inertial confinement for years and years and years. They make the lasers more powerful. They make the implosion more symmetrical, and that was just so key. Tweaking, and last year they came 70% of the way to where they came last week. And so I have in my notes here, what the hell happened at 1:03 a.m. December 5th? All right, they've got 192 UV ultraviolet lasers, and they hit a cylinder, and then that creates X-rays from the ultraviolet lasers, and that implodes and compresses a little tiny nugget of hydrogen, or they're actually, it's isotopes, it's deuterium and tritium. And in 100 trillionths of a second, all of this stuff happens. It reaches temperatures and densities hotter than the center of the sun, and it's gotta be even worse than the center of the sun because of reasons that I forget right now exactly.
I'll tell you why, very quickly.
Why?
So if you look at the temperature of the core of the sun, it's not hot or dense enough to fuse hydrogen. But that's because that's the average density and temperature. If you take the curve of temperature and pressure at the high end, that's where all the fusion's happening.
So there's areas in the sun that are more hot than others.
Yeah.
So it's like marbling.
Fusion is not occurring at those
places. Yeah, yeah. So it's only occurring where at the right side of the curve where you have, it's like, you know, how fast are the hydrogen atoms moving? Well, they have an average speed, but it's the fastest ones that are causing the fusion. Gotcha. But of course, we don't have that when we have a tiny little pellet of hydrogen and deuterium and tritium. We don't have a sun's worth of it, so we have to get the temperature up hotter than the average temperature of the core of the sun.
Right. So it's when this compressed last week, they hit ignition. So what exactly is ignition? It's essentially sustained fusion, such that the energy that's put in is exceeded by the energy that came out. So fusion was happening. It's always trying to cool itself. And that's why a lot of the experiments in the past have failed, because it's cooling too fast and it's not sustaining itself. What they were able to do was to do it long enough and symmetrical enough and everything else just perfect so that the energy that went in was exceeded by the energy that came out. They put 2 megajoules of energy into that little nugget, and 3 megajoules came out. That's basically the bottom line of what happened here.
Right. How long?
A 100 trillionth of a second. I mean, this happened incredibly fast. And I love how the scientist said, and we knew something special happened because, man, it never happened like that before.
Yeah. But when you say sustained, the event lasted for less than a second.
Yeah, but that's because that's how much fuel they had. Yeah, right? The fuel got used up.
Nugget, so it burnt itself out.
Yeah, it burnt itself out.
Right.
How would they get more fuel inside the laser confinement area?
That's a good question. So
make it bigger.
And what they would have to do is they'd have to have the facility set up so that they could do that. What they did, they have to do it multiple times a minute, like 3 or 4 times a minute. Mm. Be like a putt type of thing.
Right.
But 2 megajoules, that's like a pound of TNT. So it's not like this major explosion. But the interesting thing about that, though, is that a pound of TNT went off in 100 trillionths of a second.
Right.
You said 2 went in and 3 came out?
2 megajoules went in.
Okay.
And 3 came out.
Yeah, so last year they were at 70%, and now they're at 150%.
Right. That's enough.
So
no,
that's...
it isn't, and we'll tell you why.
Okay.
And there's no way that could be some kind of mistake or some kind of weird.
It's always possible, but they were. People said to the scientists, it's been a week. Why come you're doing a news item, a news press release a week later? They're like, because we vetted the crap out of this, because they brought all of their scientists in. And they looked at all the data, and they said, yup, this is what happened. Then they brought an outside group of experts and said, look at our data and let you tell us what you think happened. And they're like, yup, that's what happened. So they vetted the crap out of it, because the last thing they want to do is to go out and say, yeah, we had ignition, and then later on, like, oh, crap, sorry, we really didn't have ignition. That's the last thing.
They don't want a Pons and Fleischmann.
Oh, my God, that would have been bad.
Totally.
So I got to say that, got to give major kudos. This has been decades, 60, 70 years, trying to figure this out. It's been, these scientists were truly standing on the shoulders of giants, because this has been looked at and researched by scientists all over the world. It's engineering porn too, because this is just like, this thing that they created is such an amazingly complex machine that they've been tweaking for so long. Let's see.
Now tell us why this is never going
to
work.
Right. So I have my notes here. Bring it down to earth, Bob. So I'm going to bring it down to earth. But I'll end with a quote. U.S. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said at a Washington, D.C. media briefing, simply put, this is one of the most impressive scientific feats of the 21st century. And I don't necessarily disagree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the century is not that old. But it's still an amazing feat. And not because, this is going to directly lead to clean energy for the whole world. Not necessarily. But in terms of like figuring out something that's so complex as fusion, now they can study fusion. And don't forget, this is a government lab, and their goal was not to create clean energy. Their goal was to study fusion, because they've got a lot of nukes hanging out, and they want to know they want to know how to manage this stockpile of nuclear weapons safely. And so they wanted to learn about fusion. And it's really just a happy accident. Oh, yeah, we're studying fusion. And this also could lead to clean energy for the entire world for millennia. So it's kind of like a happy accident. But that's not their goal. Their goal was not to create fusion for everybody. It was to learn about fusion. All right, bringing it down to Earth. Think about the word break even. Technically, they hit a break. They hit a break even state called scientific break even. They created, you know, as much or more energy that they put in. They created that. So that's scientific break even. But that's not really break even, because there's engineering break even, which they didn't do. There's economic break even. They didn't do that. And there's even extrapolated break even. They didn't do that either. They've got way. They're not even close to having more energy than they put into it. The lasers that did this, 192 lasers, that was 300 megajoules. That 300 megajoules then was able to put 2 megajoules onto the hydrogen. So they went from 300 to 2. These lasers are obviously not efficient. And don't think, though, that that's a major screw-up, because they don't care about efficiency. Like I said, they're not trying to be efficient. They're trying to dump as much laser power energy onto this hydrogen as they can. They don't care about efficiency, but they have 300 megajoules. They put 2 into play and 3 came out. Is that break even? No, it's not even close to real economic break even. So there's a lot of work to be done before this is something that you're going to be plugging in stuff in your house using fusion energy.
Yeah, 2 orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
So just to get to actual break even. And yeah. that even that's not really commercial
right,
break even.
Right.
That's break
so,
even for that one wow. event. Yeah.
The question is, can this scale? Can they take this event and can they scale it to make commercial reactors? I don't know. That's tough. That's a tough call, and maybe not. Don't forget, they're using 1980s lasers. They're using old technology. It's still good. It still can dump a lot of energy out there. But it's not efficient, like I said. They think that if they use new lasers, they can make it 20% more efficient. All right, 20% is okay, but it's not a game changer. But those new lasers could fire more regularly. They can maybe do 1 or 2 a day type of thing. The lasers they have now, I don't think they can do that. So the scientists said that there's a pathway. If they make everything efficient as they can, there's a pathway to hundreds of megajoules. All right, so maybe they can get up to hundreds, but the laser power is going to get down to what? Even if it could be 100, it could be mm-hmm. the best. The scientists were then asked about commercialization. She said 3 decades. 3 decades to turn this discovery, this event, into something that would be a commercial reactor. 3 decades.
But that's
over 30 years, and that's a little bit optimistic.
But that's just this technique. There's other, mm-hmm. like you
right.
said in the beginning, there's other techniques for fusion.
Exactly. Because if you look now to the magnetic confinement with the tokamaks, with the magnetic field and the plasma, that technology is ready to scale. You just need, you know, bigger lasers and bigger magnetic fields, which you can do if you just put enough money into it. They're ready to scale. I wish that magnetic confinement research, which is still has millions of dollars, like ITER,
yeah.
ITER in Europe, and there's the Z-pinch and there's the Stellarator. There's a lot of these things. I wish they had ignition, because those technologies they're ready to scale up to a commercial reactor. And that's why I think that we may see a commercial reactor using magnetic confinement with those big tokamaks. Maybe we could see a good test bed reactor in 15 years, 20 years. I think we're going to get it sooner than inertial confinement. I mean,
sooner than inertial confinement, sure.
That's
not 20 years. The thing about the 30 years is that's the joke with fusion. Commercial fusion is 30 years away, and it always will be.
Right.
Right. So that 30 years is basically saying we have no idea. It's beyond any current pathway that we're on.
Right. I don't have a lot of hope, unfortunately, for the inertial confinement.
I neither do I. I mean, I think
because they've got to break away from the national lab, because this lab, they care about studying fusion. They don't care about clean energy.
Yeah, this is not even on a path to energy.
That's not their goal.
Yeah.
Now, they may say, the government might say, all right, we're going to now break you off, and you got to turn inertial confinement. You got to make this efficient and really run with this. And they have to say, we don't care about fusion anymore in terms of studying it for you guys. Maybe we'll do this over here.
Yeah.
But you guys, I don't know if the government.
We need a separate effort. We need because the National Ignition Facility, they're not on a path to commercial fusion. We need a completely separate endeavor if we're going to do that. And
this pathway might not be it. And I don't, I mm-hmm. think this makes me less confident that we're going to get there with inertial confinement. Because yes. even we achieve ignition and we're still, that's 1% of the way to break even, even just considering the lasers. Forget about the energy. If you think about the total energy, how much energy does it take to make the deuterium and the tritium? That's not easy to make the heavy hydrogen,
yep.
the isotopes. And then just running the whole thing and the efficiency of, you know, again, you have to heat a liquid and turn a turbine and doing all that stuff. You know, and you can't just get to like 301 joules. You know what I mean? Like, you got to produce a significant excess energy in order to make it all worthwhile. Right? And the other thing is, that's one threshold, is getting more energy out of the whole process than what was put in. Then you have to ask, what's the cost of that electricity going to be? If we could do it, but it's going to cost $1,000 a kilowatt, it's worthless commercially. So
you're saying that even though they achieved ignition, it's not good news.
It just shows you how far away we are from actually having commercial fusion with this method.
Right.
It's so far away. Saying 30 years is like, that's wishful thinking. That is not, in my opinion, any extrapolation of what we're doing now. Now, I do think the magnetic confinement, I've always thought that was a better approach, even though they haven't achieved ignition yet. But the problem with magnetic confinement, it does scale easier. The thing is, it's really expensive energy-wise and cost-wise to make those really powerful magnetic fields, right? Most of the advancement is actually just in better magnets, right? That's where we're getting those advancements. And that's because of high-temperature superconductors. That's it. That's why that's all the efficiency.
Well, one of the problems with ITER, I believe, was the fact that when they locked in their design for their tokamak and their magnetic fields, they were using old tech. And then new tech came around where you can have a stronger, smaller,
like 10 times
magnetic field.
Yeah.
And MIT has a method that's going that direction. I actually have more hope with the MIT technique.
But that's at least on a path to like better, more powerful magnets. Also, you know, we need the physical stuff that it's made out of needs to get better. It needs to get stronger, right?
Yo, Bob and Steve, we're in a hotel. You guys can just go get a room with each other.
Yeah. But here's something I didn't even mention, by the way, with the inertial confinement, is that to produce that split second of energy destroyed the mechanism. Right? You can't just keep doing it because they destroyed the containment, you know, the hull ROM, right? The thing where they have
I just assume they'd have just another hull ROM.
But what's that cost to make one of those?
I don't know.
It's not designed for sustainable energy production.
It's designed to study fusion.
It's a one-off experiment.
And they succeeded.
They
can now, they're going to have breakthroughs in studying fusion like they can never have had unless they did this. Yeah. So it's still an amazing
Absolutely. It's just not a design that's useful for commercial fusion.
Right.
We recently, like months ago, talked about yet another form of fusion. Using cavitation as the confinement. It's inertial confinement, I think.
It is. It's acoustic inertial confinement. It's acoustic.
And acoustic
maybe, that, maybe that technique is the one that's the most practical. I don't know. But I can guarantee you this. We will at some point, I don't know when, we will have fusion because it's just too compelling. It's too much of an amazing power source. And if you read our book, Skeptics Guide to the Future, we talk about how we think that fusion technology, we will have a fusion economy. We will be using and tweaking fusion power sources for centuries,
thousands of years,
if not millennia. We're going to be tweaking that for many centuries.
Once we do get it, it is an incredible source of energy.
It's not going to be one of those technologies where like, ah, oh, we don't really need it because other technologies. I mean, we're not going to have any other.
It will supersede everything else.
In terms of generating power for the economy,
well, it'd be nice to have it on the moon.
Yeah, so there are locations where it's going to be more practical than any other form of energy. Like solar on the moon is not great because the day is so long. But you can't go 30 days.
Fission is doing some good stuff with the remote power generation.
Yeah, but it's not. And then also, like you go to Mars, the solar power is 50%. Than on Earth, and if you go up to Jupiter, it's like 5% of it. So when you get away from a sun, your solar power becomes immediately very, very inefficient. So there's going to be lots of contexts where fusion is just going to be necessary if you need a lot of reliable power. Also, where fusion's really going to be indispensable is in space travel. Because yeah. there's basically going to be two space travel technologies that are going to be the most important long-term, especially for long distances. Light sails and fusion power. Those are the two
yeah.
that we're going to explore the universe. Those are the two. You can't do it on, you know, on it, on chemical rockets. You can't, you know, fission's pretty good, but it's not as good as fusion. So fusion's going to be it. We have to perfect fusion.
It's going to be it for basically. A long time until you get to crazy, like, black hole drives yeah, and antimatter.
Are there any commercial companies that are working on fusion, or is it all just research?
I think there are, but the real cutting-edge research is at multiple nations kind yeah. of level, you yeah. know.
Okay.
It's just a huge, it's just
it's too big.
Billions of dollars for decades. You can't do that as a yeah. private company.
Yeah. It's again. Not a business model. Right?
Yeah.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I'm very optimistic about fusion, just not anytime soon, is the bottom line. I yeah. think it's a technology for, at best, the second half of the 21st century, not the first half of the 21st century. Yeah. At best. We're going to go to Jay, who's going to give us an update on Artemis.
So right. we got Artemis 1. Artemis 1, as everybody knows, we had a launch recently, and I was curious to know, like, well, how well did things go? Well, it went really, really good. So first off, Artemis 1 was created to demonstrate Orion systems in a space flight environment and ensure that everything worked. Did reentry work? The descent, splashdown, recovery? All of these things were absolutely necessary to go right in order for us to move on to Artemis 2. So when you think about Artemis 1, Artemis 1 was, let's try out all this new, all these new workflows and gear and technology and everything that we've created, and will it work? And the fact is that it worked really well. In fact, it worked so well that Artemis 2 is 100% greenlit, and they're working at a very, very heavy and fast pace to get Artemis 2 on its feet.
So there will be a sequel.
There will be a sequel. Yeah. I mean, at this point, we know there's going to be Artemis 1, 2, and 3.
Yeah.
We know, unless something horrible happens with Artemis 2.
Have you laid out exactly what 2 is? Is that part of what you're...
Yeah, well, I mean, I could talk about it. I know. I mean, Artemis 2 is getting humans in orbit around the moon. Right? So they're going to test out everything with astronauts. But there isn't going to be anything beyond just orbiting the moon. It'll be exactly what Artemis 1 did,
right?
With you know, live astronauts in the second version of the spacesuits, which we don't have yet. So the current timeline that we're seeing, like, you know, we have like a 2024 date, maybe into 2025. A lot of people are saying that the timeline is loose.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're probably not going to hit the early dates. You know, so we're probably not going to do Artemis 3 in 2025. It's probably going to be more like it'll be more like 6 or 7.
Yeah.
So the good news is that the Space Launch System did a great job.
Amazing.
It had some hiccups, which we know about. You know, it had the hydrogen issues.
Yeah, apparently that's, like, you know, well, one or two previous attempts at launching had to be scrubbed because of a hydrogen fuel leak. And they had it again. They had to send the team out there at the last minute to plug it. That's just a chronic problem.
Well, it's hydrogen, though. It's not – they really didn't have, like – engineering problems. Like, hydrogen is just really finicky to work with.
Yeah.
And it's dangerous.
Well, liquid hydrogen.
Liquid hydrogen.
Super cooled, yeah.
But, you know, even with those hiccups, they got past it, and the rocket did what it did everything it was supposed to do. And that is a really big statement. So the rocket's performance was off by less than 0.3% in all ways that it's measured. And that's really significant. Like, so we're talking about everything that they could measure was only off by 0.3. That means that the engineers did an absolute remarkable job. Now, I know they had a long time, right? You know, they went way over budget and they went way over time on this. But when we look at the numbers and we see that they're 0.3%, you know, in line with what they predicted that they were going to do, that is freaking, you know, miraculous engineering. I want to get to my favorite thing that I learned about the launch. So the SLS is so powerful.
How powerful is it?
It damaged the launch pad in a way that the launch pad hadn't been damaged before. And it's all cool damage. Let me go through this. I did not read that they anticipated it. You'd think that they would be able to predict these things, but I didn't say, nobody said, we knew it was going to happen. Like, I don't think they knew it was going to happen. So they scorched the shit out of the launch pad.
Well,
it ripped paint off of parts. It cooked a bunch of cameras. hoses that carry fuel got damaged, severely damaged during liftoff. There was a massive shockwave. Check this out. I love this. There was a shockwave. So as the rocket lifted off, it created a shockwave, and it tore the elevator doors off the elevator that takes the astronauts up to the top. Just blew the doors right off the thing.
What's the death radius of that launch?
Holy shit! It's got to be pretty big.
I remember when I was down there, I was visiting. I was watching a launch of a much smaller rocket at NASA. They were telling, I think for the Apollo, if you were within a mile, it would kill you.
Yeah,
like that shock wave is deadly.
Whoa, a mile.
Yeah,
a mile.
Yeah, you have to view it. The viewing stand for an Apollo launch was like 5 miles away. Yeah, you can't get closer to that.
Now, you think about the Saturn V rocket that they use for that, right? SLS kicks its ass.
Yeah, it's stronger.
In all ways that you can measure it. It's just so much more powerful. Yeah. So, yeah, the shockwave.
Do they do the water dump thing still?
Yeah.
They still do that, right?
If they didn't do that, there would be.
Still the damage happened with this.
Oh, yeah. If they didn't do the water thing, there would be nothing left on the ground.
Yeah. Right.
That water, like, dampens everything.
Explain the water thing, because, like, I never knew that they did that.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, so the water.
Aware what happens.
The water thing, one huge thing that it does is it keeps sound in. It dampens the sound. And the sound, you know, that sound, it can be so intense that it can do damage.
I mean, it's a million gallons or some crazy number?
Yeah, they open the floodgates, they just pour water. It's basically underneath the rocket. And so that absorbs a lot of that heat, a lot of that energy.
So when you see this giant plume come out when the rocket takes off, that's all steam.
Yeah. That's all steam. Well, water vapor.
Yeah. Yeah, water vapor.
That's the coolest thing in the world, man. It's like, oh, I used to think that was some kind of exhaust smoke fuel thing.
The downside to the SLS is that these rockets are not reusable. Some components of the Orion, you know,
like a fusion sample,
are reusable. I couldn't find out exactly what, but there are some.
So they cannibalize.
Yeah, they'll cannibalize the old one and pull some stuff off of there.
I think they made the right decision, though, not making them reusable, because this is a launch a year, and for them to engineer in reusability just didn't make economic sense.
You know, the downside to this is that we're talking about an amazing amount of money here. I mean, each rocket is going to cost, and these are the low numbers. Each one of them is going to cost over $4 billion to produce. You know,
crazy.
You know, with inflation and with just the creep of cost, like, you know, that those dollars can go up. And as much as four, you know, it's funny. Like, we talk about billions of dollars today, and like those, it kind of doesn't feel like a lot of money anymore. It's a load of money. $1 billion is so much freaking money.
Compare it to the overall budget of NASA. That's a huge chunk of their money.
So $4 billion per disposable rocket to get stuff into space in that one shot. That's an amazing. That's an amazing bill.
Is that like total cost, like in terms of design, implementation, construction, or is that like material?
I think that, like, when they say let's build Artemis II, $4 billion.
Okay.
Like, so that's what it costs.
I think they amortize some of the cost of the system, though, when they talk about that.
I don't know. I mean,
yeah, but
I
think that's what I've read.
They amortize, but they work it in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still part of the calculation.
It's still part of the overall.
Yeah.
Because that's crazy.
Now, I love that the United States spends this kind of money on, you know, it's great that we're back in space. It's great. It's great what SpaceX is doing. I love it. It's awesome, and I think this project is freaking awesome. I mean, sending people back to the moon, I'm not putting it down at all. I just marvel at how much money it costs to do these things. So there was a non-mission critical objective called, they launched 10 CubeSats. So these are cube satellites.
Yeah.
So we put 10 of them out there in deep space, and 4 of them failed.
Yeah, so six of them are out there.
6 of them survived. 4 of them failed for different reasons. They, you know, these were satellites that were made by different companies. You know, it wasn't like, you know, they weren't all like NASA built. I'm sure NASA helped them, but, you know, like one of them had a battery problem. That's it. You know, a $300 million satellite just
bad thing.
Bad battery.
Didn't change the batteries.
Yep. And I question whether or not the delays had anything to do with some of these problems. Because, you know, if they delay long enough, if the SLS launch gets delayed long enough, they have to bring the whole thing back in and swap out these batteries that aren't like, you know, hey, let me just put in a AAA here. It's like a big freaking deal. The crew module did a remarkably well job on its mission. The Orion crew module used less fuel than they predicted. It was more efficient.
Good.
Yeah, which is you know, unbelievably critical when you're maneuvering out in outer space. You know, think about it. Like, which was it? The first time we landed, not the first time, but when we, you know, Armstrong went on the moon, he had 7 seconds of fuel left, 7 or 9
Something
seconds
like
of fuel
that. Yeah,
left.
Very little.
I mean, that's, you know, you don't want to be on those razor thin margins. There was also an issue with communications on November 23rd. That was 1 week into the mission. They lost contact with the Orion module for 47 minutes, and they still don't know why. It wasn't because it was behind the moon.
Yeah.
They just lost contact, and they don't have an
answer
yet. Maybe
their system have to reboot or something?
No, I mean, there was, like, some of the external components, you know, like a radio array, it got more damage than they expected it to in outer space, but it was still functioning. It was still, like, good enough to use. It just wouldn't have lasted much longer than it did.
Yeah, yeah.
But, no, we had something major happen for 47 minutes. Now, imagine you're in mission control, and you lose contact with the Orion module, and 47 minutes, you're like, it's gone. Like,
yeah,
like
you could have blown up.
Yeah, you know?
Hit by a meteor.
Yeah. Yeah. They must have been totally losing it.
Yeah.
But luckily, they reconnected. Like, and the last thing I'll talk about here is the mannequins, they had the first generation of the crew spacesuits that had sensors all over them. I searched like crazy, and I couldn't find anything that talked about how well the mannequins, like,
they weren't all mangled when they got back.
No, they didn't.
The horror expressions on their face.
I think we would have heard if there was something that was really bad about it. But, you know, so right now we have two things that are troublesome. It's version 2 of the spacesuits, and it's the lunar lander. Mm-hmm. Those are the two big things that they're saying, you know, these are the things that if anything's going to stop us, it's those things.
Because we don't have them yet.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I liked the fact that when they brought the Orion capsule back, it skipped off the atmosphere on purpose. I mean, the reentry trajectory brought it in. So normally, like, the capsules have to come in at a specific angle so that they don't skip off the atmosphere that they come in. But they built in one skip and then coming back down because it helped slow it down and also help them control better where they came down. The interesting thing is, you know, the Orion capsule isn't just a big capsule. It's rated for deep space.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we talked previously about that. What is it? What does that mean? It's rated for deep space. They come in a lot faster than the capsules that go up into low Earth orbit. Like, the Dragon capsule you can't send that to the moon and back, right? It would burn up and it could never survive reentry.
Yeah.
So the Orion capsule is completely different and differently engineered to survive reentry from deep space.
Yeah, it was
from the moon.
It came in at 24,500 miles per hour. That's Mach 32.
Yeah.
And that is the fastest reentry we've ever had.
Wow. Yeah.
So the mission was 25 days, 10 hours, and 53 minutes. It traveled 1.3 million miles. Again, like, that's a number. Like, oh yeah, like, how do you wrap your head around 1.3 million miles? The maximum distance from the Earth, 268,554 miles, or 432,194 kilometers. So that's a record.
Wait, can people do Mach 32?
Yeah, sure. There's no limit on speed, only acceleration.
Right, but when they hit the atmosphere at that.
Well, that's why they had the mannequins in there with the sensors on them, right?
Right. So but do we know what happened inside of the mannequins?
So, well, apparently it was fine, right? But that's why you had to slow down slowly. You can't just barrel into the atmosphere. That's why they did the
skip. But the one skip was slow enough?
I guess.
And this is the first time that they've done that.
Yeah, the mannequins can't tell us how it felt.
I got to be honest with you. I'm a little, like, why isn't there data on all the sensors? Because they kept saying, we've got all these sensors on the mannequins. And, like, and they're like,
I don't know how many G-forces did they
have. Yeah, like, what happened? Where's what re-entry is like?
All those little, you know, impact bubbles burst. You know,
can you imagine? It's like, this all works and it's great, but no human can survive re-entry.
Exactly. Yeah. But your head has to be perfectly straight, because if you twist it just a little bit, your brain will
stop. Yeah, the number you want to know is, what were the G-forces
re-entry? Exactly.
So I got one more stat for you guys. So,
and for how long?
Probably. And for how long?
The SLS did 8.8 million pounds of thrust on liftoff, and that is 1.3 million pounds more powerful than Saturn V.
Yeah.
So that's a huge increase.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's one of the great things about chemical rockets, the thrust.
The thrust is the best.
Hook. I mean, even nuclear rockets, you know, aren't doing that.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's just too bad you can't thrust that long for longer.
Bob, you have a problem thrusting for a long time?
You guys are so... That thrust. Yeah. I can thrust for longer. It's just... It's your mind. Right.
Cut her. Karen, you love every second of it. Just cut the crap.
Amen. I tell you.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about our sponsor this week, BetterHelp.
Guys, as you know, I've been going to therapy for my entire adult life, on and off, and therapy has helped me in ways that I can't even describe. Just an unbelievable way to find out ways to deal with your anxiety and your stress and anything that's troubling me. You know, I would talk to my therapist about. So I personally highly recommend that if you're feeling any kind of mental problems, that you should go talk to a professional.
And one way you can do that is by using BetterHelp Online Therapy. With BetterHelp, you can learn coping skills, self-empowerment, how to deal with your trauma, and so much more.
As the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp has matched 3 million people with professionally licensed and vetted therapists available 100% online. Plus, it's affordable. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to match with a therapist. If things aren't clicking, you can easily switch to a new therapist anytime. It couldn't be simpler. No waiting rooms, no traffic, no endless searching for the right therapist. Learn more and save 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/SGU. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/SGU.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
All right, Kara, well, you're going to tell us about cuttlefish.
Yes, I'm going to talk about cuttlefish. And I don't, cuttlefish are cephalopods. I don't know if you guys know. I don't know, this is the tiniest picture. It's a podcast. They can't see it anyway.
Cephalopodcast.
Cephalopod. There probably is one called the Cephalopod. Yeah, there has to be, right?
There's a cephalopod. Well,
I'm sure that's out there.
There's a horror podcast that was called Pseudopod.
Pseudopod.
No.
Cephalopod, but, I think cephalopod
a
was
a horror podcast. Yeah. All those names.
Yeah.
Just like the geologic. Pseudopod.
And escape pod.
Escape pod. Right. Damn it! All of those.
Yeah, those are early ones.
Why is a podcast called a podcast?
Because
of the iPod.
iPod.
But why is the iPad called an iPod?
That's
Apple marketing.
Jobs? Just thought,
right, but like but they were just thinking of the word pod, not like the when we think of pod in you know the Latin root for animals, pod.
Foot.
Yeah. So a cephalopod is a head foot.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
A pseudopod is a false foot. So yeah, cuttlefish is one of the cephalopods. You probably know about squids and octopuses.
Octopi.
It's all good.
Octopuses.
It's all good.
And squids. Or are they just many squid?
He's not going to correct you.
Is it one squid, two squid? Or is it one squid,
red squid,
blue squid? Thank you.
I don't know.
I think it's squid is plural. But for octopus, it's octopuses, octopi. It's all acceptable.
But it's not octopod.
No.
That's wrong.
No.
What?
I want to say squids.
Kara, one squid is a Squidward.
Is it cuttlefish?
Yes.
Probably not cuttlefishes.
No.
Well, it depends if there's different
more,
types.
More cuttlefishes in the sea?
Yeah. If you have cuttlefish is many of one kind, but cuttlefishes is many of different kinds.
And by the way, it's cuttle, not cuddle.
Right.
Like, not cuddle. Yeah.
Are we spelling this?
Cuttlefish, not cuddlefish.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cuttle.
So you don't cuddle with them?
You could.
They're pretty
cute.
Very smart, and that's what we're going to talk about.
Very smart.
So we've talked on the show about different ways to test intelligence, cognition, different components of intelligence, because we know intelligence is not one thing. We also know that we don't really, like, intelligence as a construct is not well-defined. Like, what is intelligence? It's measured a lot of different ways. Historically, intelligence testing among human beings is very fraught. And so even the word intelligence is not a very meaningful word, but, you know, you'll often hear psychologists and neurologists and individuals within kind of clinical sciences saying cognitive as opposed to intellectual, but sometimes we still use that term. Anyway, there are different ways to test it. We've talked a lot about the mirror test in here, but we're going to talk about the marshmallow test today, and we've talked about that a lot on the show before. We know that the Stanford marshmallow test was originally designed for children, and it's a measure of delayed gratification. The question when it was first designed was, at what age are children capable of delaying their gratification, right? So the whole setup is very simple. Put a marshmallow down, say, we're going to leave the room, we're going to come back in 15 minutes, and if there's still one marshmallow there, we'll give you another one and you can eat them both. But if you eat the marshmallow, you don't get another one later. So, you know, and we've learned a lot of things like sociocultural things. We know that it's not a pure test because obviously if somebody's very food insecure, depending on how they're raised, they may have different reactions on that test.
They may not trust that the adult will be back
totally. With the second marshmallow. So
totally.
It makes sense in their world to take what you can get when you can get it.
Totally.
Yeah.
And so the question then is, like, can animals pass the marshmallow test? And we have shown that certain corvids can pass the marshmallow test. Certain primates can pass the marshmallow test.
Are they always using a marshmallow, or is that just like the...
No, that's just like the term that we use. They almost never use marshmallows because, like...
With animals,
whatever
they
like.
It's a treat.
We're about to do a marshmallow test with cuttlefish. They could give a shit about a marshmallow.
Yeah, yeah. Some treat that they would want.
So the cuttlefish
treat. They'd like it if they tried it.
They actually use two different, because their version of the marshmallow test was not... You can't say, like, I'm going to come back later. You know, like, they're not going to know. So their version was to give them a treat that was kind of crap, but good. Not, like, disgusting. Like, something they like, kind of, versus something they love, right? So the something they liked, I love how they defined it, too. They described it in here as a piece of a raw king prawn, as if it would have been cooked. So it's a... They didn't need the word raw. So it's a piece of king prawn... So, like a dead piece of king prawn.
Okay.
And then versus a living shrimp. And the shrimp, that's like yummy to them. They want the living shrimp, I guess. And so they devised a cool box, like with these acrylic things inside of them. So the cuttlefish is hanging out, and there's these two boxes. And they put symbols on them, and this is all arbitrary. There's like a circle and a square and a triangle, but I want to get it right. So let me see. Here it is. So within the chambers, they had the circle. If there was a circle on the door.
I think they know what a circle is.
Right. If there was a circle, I'm visual and auditory. If there was a circle on the door would open immediately. If there was a triangle on the door, it would open either 10, it's like somewhere between 10 and 130 seconds, and they tried a bunch of different trials. So basically that was the delay. So immediately with the circle, delay with the triangle, and then the square was the control. It would never open. So the yummy yummy was behind there, but no matter what they did, they weren't going to be able to get to it. And the cuttlefish figured this out really quickly. And so they found that if they would wait, even though the circle door, which opens immediately, if it had like the crap treat, they wouldn't go for it if they knew that the later door would open later. Mm-hmm. So they learned it pretty quickly, which is
That's so clever. You think there's no way to test an animal.
Right?
Like you would think, how are you going to test delay gratification with a squid? Like how are you going to, and they freaking figure it out.
So not only do they recognize the shapes, right? They can recognize the objects and what they represent.
They learn their behavior.
They learn the behavior of the doors, but they know that this triangle door is that door.
So they also, they know they only get one treat. So if they take the crappy treat out of the circle box.
That's it.
They will not get the good treat.
They will not get the good treat
later.
But
if they don't take it,
then the
and
next
they
one.
Wait, right. They'll get the good treat out
but,
of the triangle.
But in the control group, no matter what they do, they never get it.
Yeah.
And so that's like a, they need that, right, to show, like, I'm waiting, I'm still not going to get the really good thing that's behind there.
Yeah.
But here's something else that's really interesting. They decided later to do kind of a version of the Wisconsin card sort. And so I don't know, like, this is like a classic test that's given in neuropsychology and neurology for executive functions. It's like a frontal lobe, like if you're looking at frontal lobe dysfunction. And it's an interesting paradigm, but basically it's about pattern recognition. And then we switch it up on the patient. And a patient who has a certain type of dysfunction is going to perseverate and keep going back to the old pattern. It's going to be hard for them to switch into a new pattern. They did something similar with these cuttlefish where they use different shapes again, and they would learn that, like, this shape means you get this treat. Mm. And then they would switch it up on them. And the cuttlefish that were the best, this was a, by the way, this was a small sample size. It was only 6 cuttlefish that they worked with, but whatever. You only need one, to show that they have capacity. And so they showed that of the 6 cuttlefish, the ones that performed the best on the card sort version were also the ones that picked up the marshmallow test the fastest. Mm-hmm. So clearly you also saw a range of cognitive capability of intellectual functioning within the cuttlefish. But the question has been, why? So with primates, with corvids, researchers think that the reason that they need delayed gratification has to do with, like, tool making, mm-hmm. right? Like, if I want to get to, if I want to be able to eat something or to be able to have some sort of reward, but I need to create a tool in order to get it or make a, you know, use a found tool in order to get it, I need to be able to see multiple steps ahead, right? And I have to delay my gratification.
But cuttlefish have never been observed to use tools. There was another one, another reason. Oh, they also don't, like, cache food, right? Like, they don't hide food around and then find it later. So they were like, that's another reason that delayed gratification would make sense. You need to be able to see that. But they think it has to something to do with how they how they look for food. So cuttlefish use camouflage, but they can only uncamouflage, or they have to uncamouflage when they're moving. Mm-hmm. And so they have to be really smart about when they go out to actually search for food.
So they have to be patient?
Patient. Like, they're protected when they're camouflaged, but when they're going out to get their food, it has to almost be premeditated. They have to plan it.
So they wait for a good food opportunity.
Exactly.
It's worth it to go out.
Yes, instead of going out for poorer nutritional quality or food opportunities that they're not likely to catch, they wait until they have a better opportunity, and they think that that's why they would have developed delayed gratification. Yeah. Yeah.
My understanding is that chimps don't do well on the marshmallow test. And the interpretation of that is because chimps exhibit a behavior that researchers call greedy.
Right.
Like, they cannot forego what's in front of them.
Right.
Even though they learn that if they wait, they'll get more. Even knowing it, like, I don't care, I have to take this thing, it's right in front of me, I want it right now.
It's really interesting. Yeah, because chimps also, like, I bet you bonobos do well on the marshmallow test, probably for similar reasons.
I don't think I'd do well on that test. I'm not good with delayed gratification.
I wonder how you would have done as a kid.
Probably terrible.
You think? Yeah. I mean, and like marshmallow, whatever. We don't have to use marshmallows because that's like a weird paradigm now.
Jay, it's the meatball test.
The meatball test.
Forget
Jay,
it.
I'm
Rail.
Awesome at delayed gratification. Oh, like, I'm too good at it, though. Like, I almost punish myself sometimes.
Yeah. Jay, how do you do with the mirror test?
The mirror test?
Yeah.
It took me a few years to figure out it was me.
You've all seen My Octopus Teacher, right? Have you talked about that?
Have you seen the parody of My Octopus Teacher?
No.
Okay.
Oh, wait.
So you've seen the trailer for My Octopus Teacher, where he's like, oh, I fell in love with it, you know,
right.
And then I saw it. And so somebody did scene for scene, line by line, a parody with like a pool cleaner.
It's
so good.
Oh, cool. Okay.
It's so good. I have problems with My Octopus Teacher.
Yeah?
Yeah, ethically.
Really?
He personified the shit out of that octopus.
Well, yeah.
And he, like, invaded its territory and was like, he loves me. And it's like, no, you're just, like, all up on his octopus this whole movie. Like, you couldn't get away. She couldn't get away from you. Yeah.
All right, George.
Yes, sir.
Yes, you're going to jibber-jabber about jibber-jabber.
What?
I'm always fascinated with weird linguistic little rules and things that we just sort of inherently know and that aren't necessarily taught, but that make complete sense. And there's these rules in English, and I think every language has it, but English is pretty good at having these implied rules that you never quite sit down and learn, but they become obvious. If I say pong ping or splash splish, it feels weird, right?
Mm. Yeah.
Or if you say zag zig.
That's just wrong.
It's just wrong.
But is that also just because we're so trained on those
other
words?
Question. That's the question. Tock-tick. Just weird. Well, there's this thing called the unwritten Blaut reduplication rule. Reduplication is a thing that happens linguistically, and there's five other examples of reduplication, which we'll get to in a minute. But this rule, they don't know why. There's theories. There's some ideas about why, when we do tend to pair words that sound similar in that way, the short vowel is first, followed by the long vowel. Mm-hmm. So it's zig, zag. It's teeter, totter. So it's always the I, then an A or an O.
Oh, wow.
You know? And it's like you don't even know you're doing it, but you're totally doing it. Flim, flam, kitty cat, knick, knack. You don't say knack, knick. It's like, ugh, it just feels weird, right? It feels so weird. Yeah, sing, song, eh, ah, eh, ah. They think it might have something to do with original language was easier to sort of because it sits high on the palate. The first part, that short eh, and then ah, is like a release. Mm-hmm. And it's more like breathing. So you have this.
Wow.
And it's tick tock or splish splash as opposed to splash splish because you can't talk. But it's this, they call it the Blaut reduplication rule, which I think it's so weird. Kong King. Like, Kong King should make sense, but it doesn't.
Right, because, mm-hmm.
Like which king?
Like, a lot of words
Kong
end
king.
In ing.
Yeah, it's King Kong, right? Yeah. There's other reduplication, and these, like, just floored me. Five other types. There's rhyming reduplication, okay? boogie woogie, easy peasy, hoity toity, right? Obvious. Those just feel good. They're funny sounding to us in a weird way. They reinforce the linguistic sort of a curiosity of the initial word gets reinforced with the rhyming of it. So that's a rhyming reduplication. There's exact reduplication, things like bye-bye or choo-choo or night-night or no-no. Okay, just like it somehow reinforces that initial thing it reinforces the first term. No-no is a very vehement no-no, which is strange because there's also a thing called contrastive focus reduplication, where you say, I'm hot, but I'm not hot, hot. Which is the total opposite, right? I'm awake. I'm not awake, awake, but I'm well awake. Yeah.
Do you like her or do you like
her? Do you like, you know?
Like, that's
and,
nutty.
And you don't, it's fascinating,
yeah,
right?
Yes, that's cool.
And we all do it. And we all, but like you never sat in class and said, this is how you emphasize if you really want to make, you
it's
know.
Not, it's not taught in a
George,
classic setting.
This must be in all languages, right?
It's apparently in a many. It's in all English speaking languages, all cultures, English speaking
cultures.
All cultures.
Yeah.
And there isn't that direct a similar thing apparently, from what I could sort of glean from this article that I found. There's the shm reduplication, which is like baby shmaby or cancer schmancer, you know. Where by adding this silly sound, you again
minimize it.
Yeah, yeah. You minimize the impact of the initial plosive word by adding this silly thing. Like, yeah, you wouldn't say schmancer cancer, right? You'd say cancer schmancer.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so interesting. And then, comparative reduplication, which isn't that big of a deal. It's higher and higher. So like, the spaceship went higher and higher. The lasers were hotter and hotter. But that, we understand, is an increase, as opposed to, again, the contrastive focus reduplication. I'm not awake. I'm not awake awake.
Yeah.
You know? It's so interesting. Mm-hmm. I like the idea of the breathing sort of entering into it, that it's this rhythmic up and down. So I wonder what it is. There must be more in other languages.
Yeah, if it's something that fundamental,
you would think, yeah.
Then you would think it would be universal among other languages versus if it is something that's more in English, then it has to be something with the way English forms.
Right,
you know,
right.
Something about English.
Right, you'd think that would be like from the PIE, which would, like the Proto-Indo-European. So all, like basically the root
right.
of most languages would have come from that.
Yeah, they were saying it's something about the Caucasus languages.
Oh, okay. So maybe just the European part.
So he says, we don't really know why this rule holds, and it's followed all over the world. It's believed it might have something to do with the movement of your tongue or the ancient language of the Caucasus. Also, it might be related to the physics of sound. Also, that tends to be many rhythms are sort of set up in this weak, strong, weak, strong, weak, strong. It's supposed to be strong, weak.
It opens strong. Like a fundamental question about like what is innate.
Right.
Like, how do we even define innateness, especially when it comes to linguistics, which is so heavily learned?
Right.
Well, I've read one very interesting theory about one way to look at, like, what is the innate grammar? What would that be?
Right.
And so how could we get at that? So one way is to look at creoles. Mm-hmm. Because creoles are any language where children basically speak a conglomeration of their two different parent languages.
Right? Oh, really?
Yeah. That's any creole.
Oh.
Yeah. So
I thought Creole was specifically like an English.
Yeah, but we
French.
Think of it as
like,
a, we
that's
think
our
of it,
Creole.
That's our Creole.
That's like,
but
yeah.
it's
a
just
Creole.
A generic term.
I didn't know that was a generic term.
For any phenomenon like that, that was English,
like
French, Creole.
Gotcha.
But there's any combination.
Like Spanglish, that's Creole.
So
German,
here's the thing.
Yiddish,
all
Creole.
Of the Creoles have common grammatical changes that they make.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh, cool.
Right? So that. So,
oh, so you wouldn't blend. You're saying you wouldn't blend two languages that are so grammatically different?
No. What I'm saying is that the children who spontaneously speak the Creole revert to innate grammar. No matter what the parent languages are that they are starting with.
Right.
And that's the theory anyway. So then, so like, you know, the whole, like, how y'all are, like, using that order, the sequence of words, and using one form of the verb for everything.
Sure.
You know,
sure.
That's the default.
Right.
So the Creoles kind of default to some kind of rules that seem to be more universal or innate.
That aren't necessarily part of the.
That
of
are
the
independent
languages.
Of the mother languages.
That is really cool.
There's something about, they say that, like, if an alien were to come down and were to look at earth languages.
Yeah.
That the grammar rules in the larger sphere are so generic.
Yeah.
That they would,
like Western languages, maybe.
No, no, I think
really?
Yeah, I was reading this thing about languages, and it was saying that in essence when you break everything down, an alien probably would think it's all one language with many creoles or many variations. Because, take out the conjugation, take out the declensions, take out the order and stuff. There is still that there is a certain thing about grammar that is inherently human.
Yeah.
And that's what separates.
Yeah.
That's why, that's why Coco wasn't talking.
You know,
for as much as that breaks everyone's heart. It's like Coco couldn't talk. Yeah.
Do you know what my favorite version of this thing that you're talking, kind of thing that feels like it's a rule, but we were never taught the rule, and we just don't know how to do it, is the infix? Do you know the infix?
No, not.
So it's like, if you were to say, like, fantastic.
Oh, yes.
You always put it in the same place.
Yes.
And nobody taught you how to do that.
Correct.
But anytime you break up a word and put another word in between.
Yeah, you wouldn't say fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. And everyone does it the same.
It's totally wrong, right? You'd be like, what do you want?
And it's like almost it feels innate.
Because there's like a rhythmic thing. It probably relates to the grammar, cadence.
Yeah, it just feels
and
right.
And you emphasize strong and the it's so interesting.
That's cool. I like that.
Mm-hmm. I love learning about those in other languages, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are some of those, like, common rules that are not formal. Like, they're informal cultural things.
Oh, yeah, and which is the challenge when you're teaching languages. Yeah. Because you're not conscious of these things, and yet someone will say, that building is very high. It's like, no, it's very tall.
Yeah.
It's a tall building. Right. People are, it's a high height, but it's a tall building. You don't learn, that's the difference of that. That's so...
My favorite one is when, because I have a lot of patients who speak Spanish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And maybe they speak a little bit of English.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when they speak a little bit of English, they always drink their medicine.
Oh,
Drink their medicine?
Yeah. Instead of taking their medicine. Yeah.
Yeah, they don't take a pill. They drink the pill.
Yeah.
Drink the pill.
Because in Spanish, it's beber. Beber la medicina, right? Huh? So they just translate it directly.
Yeah.
It's funny. Okay,
because this is so fun. Yeah. I have a friend who's a linguist, and I remember we asked him about this very American thing that we say here, which apparently they don't say in Australia, because an Australian friend was like, what is wrong with you people? In America, we say a whole nother.
Yeah.
Which is like really odd and makes me
whole
nuts.
Nother.
And so I usually will say, a whole other. But yeah, a whole nother. And I was asking my linguist friend, where did it come from? And he was saying there are two camps. It could have been an infix, like another, and we put whole in the middle, a whole nother, right? Just like fan-fucking-tastic. But it also could have been this one linguistic thing that happened a while ago, and I can't remember the name for it, but like orange didn't used to be called an orange. The fruit was norange. It was a norange.
Oh, a norange.
And it got turned into an orange. And there are a lot of words like that start with vowels.
No idea.
Right.
Because the A before it, we move the N over to the A. But the word used to be norange.
That is so
and
weird.
So it may have been that another was always the
point. Yeah, yeah.
And another.
Yeah, but we don't know. Yeah. We don't really fully know.
So there's all these linguistic fossils. like peas used to be singular.
Oh, interesting.
So like peas was, you would have a peas.
Yeah.
So the rhyme peas porridge hot, right? Remember the peas porridge? No, it's pea porridge hot, but it's peas was singular until it became confusing, and it was like, well, no, you have peas would be many, so pea is one, but pea wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
So cool,
so fun. Yeah, agree.
All right, George.
All f-ing right.
George, what do you know about closed loop pumped hydro?
Oh God.
Don't take the bait.
Reminds me of college. I don't know.
Don't take the bait.
Closed loop.
Pumped hydro.
Pumped hydro. Is that some kind of propulsion system for a submarine?
Very close guess.
Very close?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. So
good guess, George. Good guess.
If you could see Steve smile, he's so proud. It's so just like, I love it. I love it.
All right. So this.
Tell me.
It is cool. It's very, very cool. This is something I learned about not too long
ago. Engage the caterpillar drive? Is it this?
It has to do with energy.
Okay.
Grid storage.
Favorite topic.
It's a form of grid storage.
Okay.
Yes, I've been talking a lot about energy recently because of COP27 and, the world's going to be destroyed and all that stuff. So I'm very interested in what is the path between here and net zero, right? How are we going to get to the point where we, at least with our energy infrastructure, we are not putting out CO2?
Yeah.
And it's a very controversial, complicated question. I've tried to really wrap my head around it.
And so I learned about this, like, now a new technology, which actually changed my opinion about that pathway. And it's this closed loop pumped hydro. So we all know that grid storage is going to be critical to get off of fossil fuels, right? Mainly because the cleanest, cheapest source of energy is wind and solar. But wind and solar are intermittent, right? They're not on demand. The wind blows when it's going to blow, and the sun shines when it's going to shine, and we can't control that. So there's a limit to how much wind and solar we can have in the energy infrastructure. It's not an absolute limit. There's an inflection point where, you know, as you get beyond like 30-40% or so, the amount of efficiency and cost, everything, it's just crazy bad, and it just becomes really hard to manage the grid with intermittent sources. And there's also something called capacity efficiency, where how much backup capacity can you get rid of when you add new wind and solar to the grid? And beyond a certain point, it becomes zero. So basically, you have to keep all of the natural gas and coal plants open because you need them for backup power when the wind isn't blowing and the sun isn't shining. So, but the solution to that is grid storage, right? If the more grid storage you have, the more wind and solar you can have in the system. There are those who think you could have 100% wind and solar, we'll say 100% renewable, because there's going to be some hydroelectric and tidal and geothermal in there. But if you have enough grid storage,
antimatter.
But the question is it feasible to have that much grid storage, right? And of course, the other opinion is, no, it's not feasible to have that much grid storage.
Well, what kind of grid storage are you talking about?
It has to be a massive. So first of all, when you talk about grid storage, we're talking about shifting the energy production and energy usage by at least hours, right? So sun is shining during the day, you need to use electricity at night. So you need to store that energy for several hours. But what if you have a week of cloudy days or a week of no wind? You might need to shift that energy for days. And then what are you going to do over the winter when you have essentially no solar power? You may have to store that energy for months.
Or can't you just move it around?
Move what around?
The energy.
The storage?
But you're still storing it, though.
True, but I'm saying, like, you might not have the sun shining where you are for a whole month, but somebody else.
That's grid sharing, right? That's part of the solution, too, is the more you can share energy across a grid, that also allows you to have more intermittent sources.
Because the idea, we take the mean, median, and mode and figure out what's the peak.
But that only gets you so far.
Right, okay.
You still need grid storage.
Okay.
Right, because you can have a long period with little wind or little sun.
So you're saying, like, store the energy when
it's made.
Yeah, like when there's a lot of sun and a lot of wind, store that energy because we're not using all of it, and then use it for a later time.
And then and then you take that energy when you have more demand than production. Right. So right now, even with the current low level of wind and solar in the system, there are times when, like, they shut off wind turbines because there's nothing we can do with the energy. It's making more energy than the grid can take.
Does it take energy to shut them down?
Yeah, a little bit, but the point is that reduces the efficiency of that wind turbine because you're not using it.
Yeah.
And so that means that the price is fixed for building it. You're getting less energy out of it, so the cost, you know, amortized of the energies goes up. That's why it gets really inefficient.
Does that happen? I'm just curious. If we, like, obviously we're talking about cities. We're talking about large infrastructure. But if you were to look at an individual person who's off-grid, who has their own solar and their own power walls, like their own batteries, does that happen? Do they get so flooded that their battery storage can't
hold on to it? If you're off the grid, it's really hard. That's why most systems, like, you're on the grid, and the grid is basically your battery, right? So you just send the extra power to the grid, and then you take it off the grid when you need it. And the other thing is, have you ever priced out home battery?
Yeah,
it's like ridiculous.
Yeah,
it's $20,000 for 3 hours of power. I mean, that's what we're talking about. It's really, really expensive. Imagine having days of power. Like, it would be, you can't do it. So we've talked about many different kinds of grid storage before. The best is probably lithium-ion batteries. The round-trip efficiency is really good, like 92%, low 90s. Problem is, we only have so much, you know, lithium and cobalt and nickel and stuff, and we want those batteries for our cars.
Right.
We can't divert it all for grid storage.
But we can also use our cars as
home to some
storage.
Extent, you know.
Yeah.
there's going to be some battery grid storage, and that's going to help with that shifting of hours, mm-hmm. right? Getting that peak shaving, right? Getting some of that peak demand from energy that you stored up earlier in the day. But it's not going to fix the problem. It's not going to get us to high penetration of wind and solar. So then the question is then, well, what's the rest of the energy going to be? I think, you know, it's going to be even optimistically 10 to 15% hydroelectric and geothermal. That's optimistically 10 to 15%, which means you probably are going to need 20 to 30% nuclear.
Yeah.
Right.
And if we want to get away from natural gas.
Right. Otherwise, it's going to be fossil fuel.
Yeah.
Right? But again, there are still the proponents who are saying, no, we can get to 100% wind and solar. We just need massive amounts of grid storage. So my response to that has always been that we don't have the technology to do that. Where's all that grid storage going to come from? Months of grid storage, where's that going to come from? Well, enter closed loop pumped hydro, which might be the solution that we're looking for.
Submarines are the solution? What?
So this is what it is. So first of all, pumped hydro, is already an established and probably the best form of grid energy storage. If you have a hydroelectric plant, right, you dam a river, you use the flow of that water to you control the flow of that water, so you run it past turbines, which turn and make electricity, like all electricity is like you turn turbines. Mm-hmm. But in order for a hydroelectric plant to work, you need a source of water, right? That's why you dam a river. But it's hugely impactful on the local environment, mm-hmm. and there's only so many locations we can put them. They're really limited. Right now, in the United States, hydroelectric is 6% of our energy production, and we only have the capacity for about 50% more than we currently have. That's it. That's like all the if we developed every location we can develop, we get up to 9%, but actually by the time we did that, it would probably still be about 6% because demand is going to increase by 50%.
Well, not just that. Like, we're literally losing our water.
Yeah, well, that's
like,
the other issue.
You know, like,
we've had to actually shut down some hydroelectric plants because there was no water.
Yeah.
Wow. So that's a problem as well. So that might further limit that. And so that also limits, those. So pumped hydro means that when you have excess energy, you run the turbines backwards, right? You basically pump the water up to the top. You could, some designs, you could actually use the same turbines to just reverse.
So make sure you explain this. Like, so you have a body of water.
Yes.
At one altitude and another body of water at a higher altitude.
Yes.
So when you have excess energy, you pump the water from
the energy to pump the water up to a higher reservoir.
And then when you need energy, you run it
down across the
it's
turbine.
Funny. Yes. This is almost like the liquid version. Do you remember that weird thing you talked
about? Yeah, they build the tower.
You know, with the crane.
Yeah,
the rocks.
Yeah. I like that thing.
I like it too. This is like the water version.
Yeah, which is much better.
Yeah.
So again, but the problem is there's only so many locations of blah, blah, blah. There's only going to be so much.
Right.
Now, closed loop pumped hydro. You eliminate the hydroelectric power, so you don't need a river, you don't need a dam, you just need two reservoirs of water with a good head. The head is the difference in altitude between the two.
Right.
And they have to be relatively close together. They could be 2 kilometers apart. You just run a pipe from one to the other.
But you could cap them so you didn't have evaporation, too.
Well, you could minimize the evaporation.
Yeah,
you want to get the evaporation to less than the rainfall. Right. So then if the rain is replacing at least what is evaporating, then that's long-term storage, right?
But you could also just fully make it a closed loop. Like, you could close it off, couldn't you?
Well, I think because these need to be huge, in order for it to be really useful.
But don't we already do this?
Very little, very little.
Why?
So because we've always attached them to hydroelectric power.
Right.
But now the idea is you make it closed loop. There's no river. There's no dam. There's no source of electricity. It's just grid storage. So I've read 3 analyses, right? One specific to Australia, one specific to the United States, and one worldwide. Mm. Looking at the question, how many potential locations are there in the world or wherever where we could build a closed loop pump hydro system? How much energy storage would that equal? And compared to how much we would need in order to have a 100% renewable energy infrastructure.
Yeah, but the Australian ones go in the opposite direction.
So the question is, I asked these guys the question earlier, so I'll ask you two guys.
Yeah.
What do you think is the percentage? Like, what percent of, or, you know, if one unit is all the grid storage we would ever need in order to have a completely renewable system,
mm-hmm.
how much pumped hydro potential is there, closed loop pumped hydro?
Of the total grid storage potentiality, what percentage of that
Could we get to?
Could we feasibly do pumped hydro?
Yes, closed loop specifically. Closed loop. Forget about.
And you're talking about like where on the planet? And where's the infrastructure for? Like how could we do?
We
it?
Would have to build it, but
yeah, but like places where
the
we
places
could build
exist.
It. Right. Okay.
It's like yeah, we could build one there.
It's gonna be 3% or like 1500%. I'm gonna say 1500%.
I bet you it's high because you look really excited.
Yeah. It's even more than that. A hundred times what we would actually need.
Oh, that's great.
Which means we only would need to develop the 1% best locations in order to have all the grid storage we need around the world.
Congratulations, Phoenix. We've chosen you.
So, but the thing is, we would have to do that energy sharing situation because obviously there are regions in the world where the evap rate is significantly higher than the rainfall.
Yeah, but
rate.
The thing is, we could pick the 1% best locations.
Right, and then we just like export the energy.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is, they're everywhere. Right. Because there's lakes everywhere, you know?
Yeah, but I feel like there are places like in the Middle East where they'd be like, we're going to stick you're with not the
gonna
oil.
You're not going to put it in the Sahara. Yes.
Right, but there's some geopolitical reasons that sharing energy might be problematic.
This is
there.
Using pre-existing,
pre-existing
lake
bodies
systems,
of water,
bodies of water.
Pre-existing geography.
If you look at a map, like you know, whatever country you're from, but like United States, for example, if you look at a map of that highlights the bodies of water, there are bodies of water everywhere. They're everywhere. So this idea, like this, blew my mind when you said that that
100 times
when. That capacity is there. That means, like, this is the infrastructure that this we don't need batteries.
Right, we don't need batteries.
We use
save the batteries for the cars. Yeah. Right? We don't need them for grid storage.
But how do you move? I'm still confused. Like, once you've produced the energy.
Well, you need the grid. Yeah,
how do you move between grids?
We definitely need to upgrade the grid, right? There's no question. So, like, right now in the United States, there's 4 grids.
Right, like Texas?
There's Texas.
Yeah.
There's Alaska.
Uh-huh.
There's the eastern grid and the western grid, right? So, the eastern grid includes like Quebec and, not Quebec, some of Canada. I think Quebec is its own grid too. Mm. But anyway, it's like the whole eastern half of the United States is one grid.
Mm-hmm.
So we could literally share energy across that. Now it's one thing to be interconnected and it's another thing to be interconnected robustly so that you can share lots of energy across a long distance with little loss and you have a smart grid that can load balance and do all that good stuff. Well, so that's what we need to invest billions of dollars in our grid to improve it so that we can share over large areas. And then we need to build lots of closed-looped pumped hydro to store all of that wind power that we're installing.
So why don't we just start doing it right now?
But again, like, this is great for a country like the U.S.
It's great for most countries.
But when we talk about most countries don't have, like, massive ecological and biome shifts.
Yeah.
Most countries are a biome or, like, a small range of biome. And so when you're looking at countries... Again, like in the Middle East, where you've got low rainfall, high evap rates, somewhat geopolitically difficult boundaries.
Yeah.
How are you going to, like, I worry about this, like, it seems techno-optimist to think that this could just solve these problems with fossil fuels.
This is first of all, it's a major new approach.
Right.
Right. Which has tremendous potential.
Right.
And I think can get us a lot farther along this path.
Right.
Right. It's no one solution I think is going to get us 100% of the way there. Right. I still think we're going to need to have some nuclear power plants. Like right now we're at 18%, the United States at 18% nuclear. I think we need to at least maintain that. Like keep around 20%. And then we get 10% geothermal and hydroelectric and then 70% wind and solar with lots of grid storage, but that's gonna need to be pumped hydro. There's nothing else scales the way it does. Nothing else scales the way it does. And it's more universal than you think, but absolutely there are places that where it's gonna be less useful. Mm-hmm. But also if you think about the countries that are producing all the CO2, they'll be fine. Right, they'll have
that's true. The places where we need to like
China,
stop
India,
the
United States, Europe, those they have a plenty of locations.
Right.
Now in the U.S. right now, it takes 5 to 10 years just to get the permitting to build one of these facilities. So that's a huge problem.
Well, can we just like have some sort of presidential decree and fix that?
So that's what we need. We need an Operation Warp Speed for this.
I mean.
For the pumped hydro. Yeah. Absolutely. Now, there already are, and again, but the thing is, it's federal and state and local regulations. It's like multiple layers of regulation, not like just the FDA where there's one institution.
There's unless these were federally funded and sponsored there would have to be
massive, you know, regulatory change at the federal level that somehow controlled the more local level things or superseded them or whatever. Now, there is a fast track where we could do it in 2 years. This already exists, but most sites don't qualify for the fast track. I'm not sure what the details are there. But definitely, I think we need to look at this and go, okay, how can we make this happen as quickly as possible? It's going to take regulatory overhaul and lots of money. Mm-hmm. But it's totally worth it. Mm-hmm. It is completely worth it because this is really the only way we're going to get any significant penetration of wind and solar.
Apart from cost, what would be the potential arguments against it?
There really aren't many.
I couldn't find any.
Because these are pre-existing, you know, bodies of
structures,
water. We don't have to build any dams. It would be minimally environmentally impactful. Yeah. But again, that 5 to 10 year permitting process is all environmental.
So it's
studies.
Just all like red tape and like pork. Like those are gonna be all the problems. It's like our jurisdiction wants this.
Right, right. Yeah. But if I were king of America, I could just say let's just build a ton of pump hydro and
it seems like a no brainer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is one of those things.
Well, I think it's gonna happen. I think this is gonna be a bit of a game changer.
I mean, it was there all the time. Like it just took people to think about it and go, we could store the energy this way. I mean, and you got to think about it. When you're moving water from one place to another, like you're not damaging anything.
The technology's there, right?
So the ones we already have, where are they? Here in the
U.S. Is there a map we can look at?
Yeah,
there's not that many. There's only a couple. Then they've been, but we've had them for decades.
Right.
Like the technology's literally decades old. It was just never a big
project. Steve, Candlewood Lake has pumped hydro.
Yeah, I know.
Yep.
No way.
Yeah. Yep.
The lake where we live,
It's like I think about California and like how imperative how important it is for like us culturally and our government to like be ahead of the curve when it comes to green energy. But pumped hydro might not work there because it's like drought city. Like it's a problem. Like we don't have enough water as it is.
Yeah.
And so it is kind of we'd have to be like help us out.
Yeah, but you gotta read the analyses. Like, there's so many potential locations. Again, we only need 1%.
Right,
that's all
and
we
then
need.
We can just
think about how little that is of all the potential locations.
This reminds me of that great lamp that they were using in low-income countries, which was just a weight.
Yeah.
So it was like a weight on a pulley, basically, and you would lift the weight up, and it was a very low toothed gear that slowly would drop the weight down. And that would run your whatever 60-watt bulb
very
for 5 hours or whatever.
Yeah, I remember this.
It would slowly just go down. And then you just walk back over and you lift it back up. You know, another 5 hours of energy.
It was like a soccer ball.
Wow.
That they were
something
using.
Like that, yeah.
A lot
it was
of low
so well, grandfather
cool.
clocks,
like they were kicking the
grandfather
soccer ball
clocks run out off of gravity
and
as well.
Like a battery at night.
Like those
so
simple,
like the kids are playing soccer.
They're there. Right. The answers are there.
Yeah.
All right. Evan, you're going to finish us up with some information about satellites and astronomy.
Yeah. So, recent news on this. First of all, bright objects in the sky. They include things like, the sun.
UFOs.
UFOs. Saw that Spielberg movie. The moon, obviously. Stars, also.
Mars.
Sirius.
Jupiter.
Venus.
Sirius. Canopus.
Airplanes.
Rigel. Cantaurus is one of my favorites, absolutely. Well, now we have to count an artificial satellite as one of the brightest objects in the night sky. And it's called the Blue Walker 3. It has officially become one of the brightest objects in the night sky. And while the technology of satellite technology, which is bringing cellular service and communication around the world, that part of it is great, there are always, always trade-offs. One of the big trade-offs with this particular satellite is the impact that it's having on the study of astronomy. Because it is so bright. But not only because it's so bright, the radio emissions, the power of it itself, is also interfering with telescopes, with radio telescopes here on the planet.
What does the satellite do?
It's a communication satellite. It's for cellular service. Mm. Yep. 693 square feet is how big it is. So it's pretty big for a satellite. And causing a lot of radio traffic. And so much so that the International Astronomical Union released a statement earlier this month, which is the news item, trying to bring people's awareness to this matter. And it's not just this satellite. We've talked about other satellites in the past, you know, the Starlink satellites that have been having this sort of negative impact on astronomy as well. So the problem seems to be becoming worse and worse. This is just the prototype satellite that went up, the first one. The plan is for this company. It's called AST Space Mobile. They will be launching hundreds of these.
What? Of that 600-foot one?
Of this, and perhaps larger and more powerful Jeez. Ones. So they see the danger on the horizon, and they're really trying to bring people's awareness to it now
wow.
in order to try to help mitigate this in some way, or at least open a line of communication about what is happening. There are 3,000 Starlink satellites right now, currently in space, and that's planned to go up to 12,000. Is the ultimate plan. What else do we have?
Amazon 12,000.
12,000.
Do we all get free internet finally? Is
that like, I mean, eventually, yeah.
12,000.
I thought it was going to cap out at 20,000. So. It's the only internet in Ukraine right now. I understand.
Yeah. That's right. So again, you know, positive aspects of it, but there are also these negative ones that definitely do have to be addressed. Here are a couple of lines from the actual statement they released. Because of its large phased array antenna, BW3 for short, appears in the sky as bright as some of the brighter stars. If imaged by the very sensitive detectors of astronomical telescopes, it can easily saturate them, making the entire image useless, and in some instances, it might even damage the detector. Therefore, it's imperative to know exactly the position of such bright satellites in such a way that they do not cross the field of view of the telescope. So there has to be a better coordination effort as to exactly the paths these are taking and where our astronomical instruments are also pointing. But they also said their impact on radio astronomy is potentially serious. Large radio astronomical observatories are located in remote regions. We talked about the one in Australia recently, in order to limit the interference by the cellular phones. But if the microwave emissions come directly from the sky, no region on Earth will be immune from the interference.
Evan, can they make these satellites, like, paint them black?
Yeah. So what we have is that, and SpaceX is actually kind of all the companies leading has heard this call, and they have answered, and they have been doing things with their second and third generations of the Starlinks, for example. Back in July this year, they announced an initiative called the Brightness Mitigation Best Practices for Satellite Operators. This is SpaceX. They're identifying and mitigating the key causes of satellite brightness using new and more sophisticated materials with less reflectivity. Specular scattering material is what they're using, which reflects light at a single angle, like a direct-on angle, mm-hmm. as opposed to it going bouncing in all kinds of directions in which you would see these more prominently. Their first generation of the satellites had visors, sun visors, actually attached to them. But those are proving to be kind of problematic. While, yes, it does cut down on the amount of light, it also interferes with the capabilities of the satellite itself. The laser components on it are not as effective, and it also has a physical drag on the satellite itself. So they moved on to something called RF transparent mirrors, and intercell backing materials, in which basically they're just kind of changing the color structure of the backing material. They started off using white, you know, which has high reflectivity, but they've moved it to a dark red color, obviously, because, you know, that's better. However, that's also having some issues because of the heat. And temperature and heat issues now become a problem. So they're continuing to try to tweak it. And they have something else called dielectric, which is a mirror film. Now, this will reduce the reflectivity by 10 times. So you're going to get like 90% lower reflectivity, which seems to be working. And the new satellites that are going up are going to have this material. It maximizes the specular scatter and allows the radio waves to pass through with no apparent issues. Not only that, they're going to make this technology available to the other satellite companies that are doing this at no profit, no markup. They're going to do it to them at cost, so that they can easily implement this particular technology, which they think is going to be best for all the companies who are putting satellites out.
That's great, but this is also an area where we need some international regulation.
Sure.
Like, you shouldn't be allowed to put noisy satellites up there and ruin it for everybody.
They should code them with Vanta Black.
I was going to say Vanta Black. Yeah, definitely Vanta Black, totally.
Too bad it's so expensive.
Yeah.
Of the black. So, yeah, so again, the news this week was that the union came out with this statement and really wanted to make everyone aware of this. That this has having real right now impacts on what we're trying to, what astronomers are trying to do.
And it's part, another form of light pollution.
Yeah, yeah,
it's, but it's also a part of a much bigger problem, which, as we all know, it's all the space junk. Mm-hmm. You know,
there's a ton of stuff up there.
Yeah, we got to start pulling that stuff down somehow. Like, we've got to really make that happen. We could get into a situation where we have a chain of events happens in orbit where, you know, an accident happens, creates debris, and that debris goes out and makes more debris, yeah, and then we're totaled.
Then we can't Sandra it Bullock out. Is f***ed.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, when I was at that launch at Baikonur, it was OneWeb, which I think went defunct. I'm not sure. Somebody might have bought them since then. There's, like, been a lot of drama with that company. But they were saying that their satellites all have a shelf life, and they deorbit after yeah. that shelf life. And I think that's starting to become, that's, hopefully,
that needs to become standard, too.
Yeah,
it
yeah.
has to be.
Yeah, like, I know there's stuff up there from before, you know, yeah. but, like, you shouldn't be able to put anything up new unless you are the, you know, it will come
yeah,
back down.
You can't leave your garbage there.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And yeah. unfortunately, yeah. not all of the countries, yeah. China, have been able yeah. to kind of maintain this sort of effort to deorbit correctly there.
Well, and the problem is it's, like, up. The honor system. Mm-hmm. Like, we yeah. can't, you know, that has to be regulated.
Yeah. Yeah, in some way, you're right. There, yeah, have, to be there have to be tighter laws. Right. The whole system needs a lot of tightening. Lots of different aspects.
All right, thanks, Evan.
Yep.
All right, guys, let's move on to science or fiction.
Yes.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. There's a theme this week. What do you think the theme is?
Phoenix.
No. Fusion. Arizona.
Fusion?
No, but it's related to Arizona.
Meteors.
It is crazy. Arizona law. Arizona law. Oh, boy. Now, I want no kibitzing from the peanut gallery.
I want lots of kibitzing from the peanut gallery.
We will ask you your opinion after the rogues have all weighed in. So no right. feedback until you may have heard these. You
Did
being
you
locals.
That half the people here aren't from here. Whatever. They came
That's
in
true.
From out
we
of
have
town.
People from Missouri. From
Whatever.
California.
All right, here we go.
Let's do it.
All right. Item number one. Any misdemeanor committed while wearing a red mask is automatically considered to be a felony. Item number two. Donkeys are not permitted to sleep in bathtubs. And item number three, it is illegal in the state of Arizona to refuse someone a drink of water if they ask and you have water to give. All right, we're going to start all the way on the left. Bob? If you want to see them, I got them.
No, red mask fiction.
Red mask is the fiction, okay?
Gosh, I want to see them again.
Who knows? Jesus.
Bob. Evan, what do you think?
Why would a red mask constitute a felony? Like,
automatically. You know, what happens on Halloween? Come on.
Is it the same concept as, like, insurance companies will charge more if you have a red car? That kind of thing? I don't get it. Donkeys not permitted to sleep in bathtubs. Sure, that is some, you know, 1814 or whatever, 1912 yeah. law on the books for whatever reason. You know, those things happen all over the place, yeah. And refusing someone a drink of water if they ask, if you have water to give. Well, I mean, you can kind of see perhaps maybe, yeah, that there's a public service sort of aspect to it. A Good Samaritan laws do exist in some places. So I think I'm with Bob. The one about the red mask is making the least sense to me.
You know, I'm tempted to pick the one about the water, because it seems to be the most reasonable. Like, there's just no way that I could... These are all weird.
Jay, are you searching through his phone?
No, this phone sucks, but I mean... It doesn't stay, right?
No, it doesn't.
I am going to pick
Stop touching it.
It's been my problem my whole life,
Steve.
Did
you mean the donkey
one? I'm going to pick the water one, because out of all three of these, that one seems the most reasonable, and this seems like one of those times when... That's my. I'm going to bet that Steve is picking that.
Okay, Kara.
Right. I think we wrote. We took notes. I feel like there is an argument for all of them. Like the red mask, and it was a misdemeanor, but now it's a felony. What if there was like
some gang of bandits, like the Red Mask bandits, and at the time, like, that was written into law, and then they just, like, never repealed it, you know, because it's like those old things that they don't matter anymore, and they don't actually enforce them, so it's still on the books. Like, maybe, you know. And then same thing with the donkey in the bathtub. I'm trying to think of where would a bathtub have been outdoors at the time? Like, don't bathe your donkey in the same, maybe there was like a cholera situation. I don't know. Like, I'm trying to think of why that would be. I don't think it's like a zoning building
thing
problem, but maybe a public health measure. And then the whole, like, you can't refuse water. Yeah, totally. If there was something where, like, somebody died because they had heat stroke and they needed water, and somebody was like, ah, I can't have my water, and then they were found liable, I could see that. But also I could see this one being one that Steve just, like, straight up made up.
Yes.
Because, like, we think of Arizona, and we think of the desert, and we think of, yeah. And the other two were, like, negative, and this one's positive. I think I'm going to go with Jay on this and say Steve just made that one up.
Ooh. All right. And George.
Oh, boy. To quote the Beastie Boys, when you wash your ass, you better best use soap. So I am leaning with Kara and Jay on this.
Wow.
Very much so. But now because
you could get all the glory.
I'm thinking like you can't bring a donkey inside and have it go up to the second floor, like where your bathtub might be, because then it's going to be like a weird structural thing. The Red Mask, I like the idea of there was some kind of gang.
Yeah.
And they never took it off the books. But because no one has chosen the donkeys, and because I'm a Beastie Boys fan, I'm going to say the donkey.
You're going to go with the ass.
Yeah. All right. Yes.
Always go
it.
With the ass.
All right.
Little ass.
Now we're going to poll the locals and see what you guys think. George, you want to do your...
Oh, we'll do the one clap. Yeah, so if you think it's
so
just...
So if you think
one clap.
That the law about the Red Mask is not true, clap.
Ready?
All right. A little off there, but
it's the practice.
And then if you think that the one about the donkey is the fiction, clap.
Right.
And if you think the one about the water is the fiction, clap.
Oh.
Okay,
pretty damn even. The water.
No, they're definitely more for the water.
But still, I don't think they know.
All right.
I don't think any of us
know. So we'll take these
good
in order.
Job, but
they don't know.
Item number one, any misdemeanor committed while wearing a red mask is automatically considered to be a felony. Bob and Evan, you think this one is the fiction.
I regret it now.
About 20% of the audience thinks this one is the fiction.
20.
And this one is science. This one's a real law still on the books.
Weird.
In Arizona.
What's the origin?
I don't know why, but...
You didn't look at the origin?
I did. I couldn't find it.
So it's my story. It's
yeah. Cool. So, yeah. But that makes sense. Something like
it makes sense.
Right.
Because bandits were wearing red masks, right. So they had to, you know, whatever. Up it. Yeah.
Some political.
Yeah. Right. It's all right. Like it's worse because it was you. Right. Yeah.
Let's go on to number two. Donkeys are not permitted to sleep in bathtubs. George, you think this one is a fiction?
Yes.
Again, you got about a quarter of the audience
or so.
Give
it to George.
And this one is. Science also. Sorry, George. Yeah, I have no idea why they decided to specifically outlaw allowing donkeys to sleep in bathtubs. I guess that was a thing. At some point in Arizona.
A thing? It was like happening all over.
People were using.
One incident and one mayor went crazy over it or something and decided to lobby to have it.
Or maybe there was a sickness
one,
that
it's all it would take is one incident.
Figure this out right now.
And if anybody has any insight into this, you know, please share with us. So what this means is that it is illegal in the state of Arizona to refuse someone a drink of water if they ask and you have water to give is the fiction.
Did you make it up?
No, I didn't make that up. But there are dozens of sites on the web that say that that's a real law in Arizona. Have any of you heard of that? Any of the local Arizonans? Did you know it was a myth or did you hear it is real? So you guys all know it's a myth. Yeah. But so there was a good site that basically looked through all of Arizona law and that just doesn't exist. It's like that law does not exist in Arizona. So it's one of those things that so makes so much sense that it just becomes in popular.
I found this a couple times.
Okay.
So it's like multiple people online. This is from PhoenixArizonaCriminalLawyer.com, specific law firm. A town near Kingman was flooded by a local dam. While a merchant allowed his donkey to sleep in an old bathtub, the donkey survived the trip but was washed about a mile down the valley, landed in a basin, and it took a lot of money to rescue the animal, and they decided we're just going to ban this one.
That seems prudent, because, you know.
That's brilliant.
Yeah.
All right.
So what do me and Kara get?
Points.
You get to hear some other interesting Arizona laws.
Ooh.
That I did not use. It's also illegal to hunt camels in Arizona. Mm-hmm. No camel hunting.
Are there camels here?
Are there camels in Arizona?
No,
they were all hunted.
Yeah.
I know there are camels in Australia. They were basically introduced. Yeah, they were introduced. I figured they were introduced just like in Australia, same thing. Any misdemeanor, as I said that one, donkeys. It's a class 2 misdemeanor occurs if one places a mark upon a flag which was likely to provoke physical retaliation.
Wow. All
again, right. It's got to come from something. It is illegal to manufacture imitation cocaine. So no fake cocaine in
Arizona. They only want the real thing. That's awesome.
And this one kind of makes sense. When being attacked by a criminal or burglar, you may only protect yourself with the same weapon that the other person is using.
Wait.
So you can't bring a gun to a knife fight.
In Arizona.
That's
amazing.
So if I attack you with like a conch shell, no. You're like,
That's weird. Yeah. So I thought that was fun.
All right.
Yeah, have you ever played Red Dead Redemption 2?
No, I have not.
Yeah.
You know the answer
Literally.
To that question.
You got to put your mask up before you rob the train.
All those games I've
played. Yeah. All right, Evan, take us out with a quote.
All right, this quote was suggested by a listener. His name is Sean. He's from the United Kingdom and apparently a fan of Charles Dickens. Any Charles Dickens fans here? Me either.
Charles Dickens?
A seasonal skeptical quote from Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. Here it is. This boy is ignorance. This girl is want. Beware them both and of all their degree. But most of all, beware this boy. For on his brow I see that written, which is doom, unless the writing be erased. So, ignorance is bad.
I heartily agree. We were just talking about the Christmas Carol.
I just read it.
What would Christmas Carol?
It's really, really a great story.
It is a good story.
You know,
it's another don't be a dick story.
Yeah, that's what he means.
I mean, of all the Dickens, it's one of the most, I think, accessible ones, certainly. Yeah. And I saw the Patrick Stewart.
Oh, that was so freaking good.
I have to say, I just saw Spirited, the Will Ferrell, Ryan Reynolds film. It's great.
Is it really?
It's great. I've never had a Christmas Carol plot that I didn't know what was going to happen.
Yep. Hmm.
It's got these twists, and you're like, wait, what? Yeah. It was.
Good afternoon, sir.
Good afternoon.
No,
the musical numbers are.
The dancing.
I mean, it's just Busby Berkeley on crack. It's amazing.
Really,
it's amazing.
Fun.
Songs are great,
but not fake crack.
Fake cocaine.
Yeah. Fake. No, yeah. It's. I was blown away. I had my expectations were very low. I was playing a local theater. I'm like, oh, it's going to be fun. Let's just go check it out. It'll put us in a silly mood. We'll make fun of it or whatever. And I'm like, these songs are great. And the message was great. And it's this subversion of the Christmas Carol story that's fully aware it's subverting it. But it's super clever. I recommend it highly.
That's interesting. Because I was looking for shows to download for the plane travel.
Mm.
And I saw that on there. I'm like, hard pass.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Like, my expectations were so, but now I'll
I mean, if you don't like musicals, you're not going to like it. But if you, and I can appreciate, you know, good songwriting. Songs are very catchy, very clever, and it's a really cool message. And,
cool.
And I enjoyed it.
Very nice. Well, thank you all for joining me for
thank
this
you.
Week's show.
Thank
you guys in the live audience. You were wonderful. Give yourself a round of applause. Right. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.